Hello and welcome to Power of 10, a show about design operating at many levels of Zoom, from thoughtful detail through to transformation in organization, society, and the world. My name's Andy Pullane. I'm a design leadership coach, designer, educator, and writer. My guest today is Dr. Chuchuri Tan. She specializes in culturization strategies tailored for international growth. She leverages cultural insights to craft winning global business strategies and has partnered with industry giants, Fortune 500 companies, and household names, guiding them to navigate international markets successfully. Chuchuri's expertise lies in simplifying complex cultural landscapes into actionable strategies that drive success for businesses worldwide. She is also the author of a new book where she's gathered a lot of her knowledge together. It's called Research for Global Growth, Strategies and Guidance for Cross-Cultural Insights. Chuchuri, welcome to Power of 10.
Thank you, Andy. Thanks for having me.
So I gave you your sort of, you know, your official bio. Can you tell me a little bit about your journey here? I think I read in the book that you've been in 46 countries around the world doing, I don't know how much of that is living or traveling and how much is work. Quite a lot of it was for work. But tell me how you got into the work you're doing and what you're doing now.
Yeah. So my background is, I suppose I should actually mention about my background because I think it plays certain elements into what I'm doing now. So I'm a Malaysian Chinese. So my grandparents are actually from China. So by Malaysians, I'm very related to this country. So we follow the Chinese culture because that is our traditions and we celebrate the same celebrations as in China. But in Malaysia, it's kind of like, I don't know, your audiences and yourself know about this, but it's actually Malaysians, it's very a melting pot, really. Yeah, but yeah. It's kind of have a lot of ethnicities, like Malay, Chinese and Indians and many other ethnicities as well. So I kind of grew up in very much on the cultural, very much blended into different culture and very familiar to me without me knowing that. So my background, my undergraduate and my master is completely different. It's a mechanical engineering and then music technology in master. And but I end up doing human and computer interactions as my PhD. And that led me to user experience. Well, we call it human computer interactions and then usability and then UX and then CX, you know, like I went through the whole evolutions of our industry, really. Kind of accidentally mentioned about my age at this point. My background is customer experience, but where I start off with the globalizations and culturalizations is more when I started working with, at the time, Marriott International. I worked with them as their external global consultant, really helping them to understand their travelers and from different cultures, how they book hotels and their needs from end-to-end journey and digital experience and also in hotel. And that kind of start to bring me into, there's actually the world out there and what is different. And then I think because it's quite my route where kind of see different cultures is very common to me. So I start to kind of work on that a lot more. And then I start working for myself for the last 7 or 8 years. And I focus very much on culturalization. I call it culturalizations, mainly to help businesses to understand or simplify complex cultural landscape and into actionable strategies that actually can drive them successful globally. So it could be from launching a new market, like we are going into a new market, or this is the first time we're going into a new market, what should we do? What we should be pay attention to? Or helping businesses to take their existing market to another level. So at this moment as well, I also advise a lot of C-levels and senior management to help them to kind of uncover how their global opportunities would be. And also if they have, let's say they have two markets and they are very different functions and services, how to bring them together into one as they start to grow globally. So you can't have too many different variations to maintain and govern. So how to bring that together so that you can cater for similarities as well as differences easily, most cost efficient and productive as well.
So maybe you can kind of pull apart or unpack this difference, because you talk about the difference between localization and culturalization. And I think you sort of mentioned a lot of clients, they say, oh yeah, we're sort of already done some localization, which mainly is we've translated some of our stuff into another language. But you made the distinction here. Can you talk a bit more about what's the difference between culturalization and localization?
Yeah. So first of all, culturalizations, I don't think you can find in any dictionaries yet, but it's kind of self-explanatory for me. I think when I mentioned that people actually understand what that means in the higher level. But for me, I start off actually talking about localization with businesses, but I start to see actually there's a lot of misunderstanding and we are not talking about the same thing when we talk about localizations or culturalization. So a lot of times localizations means to a lot of businesses or senior management is, yeah, like you say, changing the language, changing the currency, and that is it. You know, like adapt design elements to the bare minimum, and that is enough to do that. But of course, we all know that actually there are more than that to make a local experience better for the local audiences. There are more things to kind of consider, your services and so on. So localization is very much more like one-off actions. So you do it once, you change the language or you change the currency, and then that is it. You know, like you doesn't feel like you need to do more than that. Whereas actually, culturalizations for me is more long-term, like you have to be continuously doing improving, because you can't be possibly know all the insights about local culture and local market, and then you do all the changes at once, and then that is it. Your knowledge about them is going to build up progressively throughout the time. And also their behaviors and things might change, their context in the countries might change because they have a better politicians and things change, economy become better.
Yeah.
They are exposed to more different technologies and so on. So the local people's behavior and mindset and things like that will start changing as well. So culturalization is about that, about kind of understanding the full picture and the holistic view, I call it. And then you keep continuing improving. And it touch on not just language, not just product, not just design or marketing, but it's actually touch on every single element of your business. And everyone have to work together so that it's actually more aligned. So that's why I tend to use the word culturalization.
Yeah. Can you give me an example? I mean, it's probably easiest, I think, to sort of hear from examples. I'm interested of, you know, what happens if they don't do this? What happens when they get it wrong? And I don't know if you've got any examples of that. You probably might not want to name names.
There's different layers of getting it wrong, right? The first layer, as I mentioned in my book as well, Research for Culture, Global Growth, is I actually have a three layers. I call it three levels of culturalizations. So getting it wrong could be the first layer where you actually create something that actually offensive to the culture or to the religions of that countries or so on. So that is kind of like the basic thing. You don't want to offend anyone because you want to build the respect. You want to kind of do that. Some of the examples I mentioned in the book, some didn't, but one of the examples was the geopolitical mistakes that a lot of companies did in terms of putting Tibet, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Macau, and all those into as a country. And so there's a backlash or they have to apologize to the Chinese government. So that's geopolitical mistake. And then you have others like there's a campaigns in by a Canadian supermarket, like huge Canadian supermarket. They kind of have this festival for the sick, but they're actually promoting, I can't remember which type of meat, like as the one of the promotions of the food, but actually it's against their religions to actually consume that kind of meat during their festival and things like that. So this is a thing of getting it wrong or make the mistake. And then the rest could be other elements where you kind of provide, for example, this again, a simple example, provide the wrong payment methods that they actually be more relevant with. Like, for example, in Kenya, M-Pesa is very common. If you don't use that and you say credit cards in a lot of countries, then they're actually not going to be relevant and you create barrier for them to actually pay. So there are different types of layers. Some is more than the others. Some is kind of like you will actually become a barrier for them to use them. Some is actually some of those mistakes is just creating something that actually would not allow you to kind of provide another layer of growth, for example, providing the experience that they kind of look forward to.
This experience and enhancement is the sort of, is the third layer, you said. Yeah. Do you see those as kind of built on each other? That you can't, you have to kind of earn the respect or earn the right to sort of be even interacting or be in a marketplace by those other layers before you can kind of get to
the enhancement.
The enhancement layer, yeah.
So the book, I have three layers. So one layer is about the respect and the second layer is about the basic customer experience where you kind of provide the right address format or name formatting, first name, last name first and all those things. And then the last one was the biggest one, but actually the most important one, the enhancement. It doesn't have to be like one layer to the others, but the respect one, I would imagine it has to be. You have to get it right first. Otherwise, like you move into a new neighborhood and you didn't have that respect, it's hard for you to do anything else to kind of gain that trust and so on. Yeah. But the rest, that's actually, it could be done concurrently or actually progressively as well.
Yeah. It's very subtle, a lot of this too. I mean, we're talking an example here, I think probably in our heads, well, in my head, there's an example of, say, a kind of a Western or American company moving into somewhere like China. But I know in Australia, for example, where there's, so I'm British, but I lived in Australia for, I'm also Australian now. I lived in Australia for a long time. And it probably took me about 2 years, I think, of being there before I really clicked of, oh, actually, this is a different culture. Because, they're speaking English, they've got the Queen's head on their money. At the same time, there's a lot of kind of American influences there as well. And it sort of feels like, oh, I know this. And I watched lots and lots of companies to come into Australia, do that classic thing of, oh, we're going to show them how these Aussies how to do this, from Europe or America, and then sort of leave 2 years later scratching their heads. And one was Starbucks. So Australia has a very, very strong, thriving coffee culture there. I mean, very kind of, baristas kind of carefully measuring everything and that, people are very particular about the coffee and it's very good. And Starbucks came and set up in the middle of kind of the, CBD, big sort of glass thing. And just kind of failed. They moved. I can't remember how long it lasted, but it just couldn't kind of get the idea that, that's not what coffee meant to Australians. And it was always interesting for me. The moment it happened for me, where I had that kind of switch, was someone saying to me, oh, we were standing by around a barbecue. I remember this. They said, I'm really looking forward to Christmas and the summer holidays. And I was like, oh my God. You've had a very different childhood to me, and there's this sort of moment of realizing everything was in fact very different and different values and all of those things, but kind of very subtle shifts. You mentioned, altering things in to match those markets or to kind of, make sure you're not offending, to gain respect and all the rest of them. And actually one of the examples you gave was around Pixar. And I found that, because there's a lot of work, obviously, to do that. Do you want to talk about the Pixar example? Because I think it's a really nice example of exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think it's a nice example and quite easily related to it, right? So Pixar is very much, they actually have I watched a documentary about them as well. They have a localizations team as well to look into all these elements. So the examples I was giving in my book and some of my talks is Inside Out. I think they have Inside Out 2 now, but the Inside Out 1 that we're talking about. So Riley, the little girl. So there are scenes that you can see that her dad is trying to feed her broccoli. And this is most of us actually see this scene. So a lot of them actually, Riley was being fed by the dad broccoli and she has this disgust feeling like, ew, I don't want to eat that. But actually in Japan, they actually see a very, very different view because they found out that broccoli actually liked by the kids in Japan for some reason. They loved it. So that doesn't really match to that kind of perceptions of kids doesn't like broccoli. So they did some research into it and they realized that actually kids in Japan didn't like green pepper. So they changed that scene. And there are quite, I think there are 26 shoots that they actually changed just for that, that scene, to change that. And then not just that, they have, I think there's another scene quite commonly known is the dad, Riley's dad actually was watching ice hockey in one of the daydreams, but actually in a lot of other markets, we see soccer or football, whatever, whichever we call. So Pixar is very, very good in kind of finding out different things. Sometimes it's just about, you know, like experience relevancy, but sometimes it's more about the language to make it easier, like conversion. Sometimes it's about the respect again. Some words you actually shouldn't be mentioned in that country because of the religion's reason. So they remove that. Or the sign you can see at the background that we might not even pay attention to, they will change that as well. To a sign or symbol that actually relate to them. Yeah, Pixar is very good examples of, you know, even small things actually create emotions, attachment to the products or the things that you created. That is very important as well.
Yeah. So, you know, in something like a film like that, obviously it creates a lot more work for them because they have to kind of re-render the shots and things. But on the other hand, it's a kind of one thing. Once they finished it, it sort of goes out there in the world and it, you know, it has different formats, but it doesn't really change. For other companies where they're, you know, they're involved in providing services and there's many, many more kind of touch points, it's more complex. You talked before about sort of finding this, is there a kind of sweet spot between how much you can do before it becomes unmanageable? And you know, by what criteria do you decide, okay, that's just enough? Or is it just a kind of budget thing? Or is there somewhere where it's, because I can imagine, so I guess where I'm going with this is I can imagine if you make it too complex, you can run the risk of missing something, right? The more complex it becomes, the more chance of making mistakes in some respects, you know, so is there a kind of bell curve there and there's a sweet spot in the middle?
Very good questions. And so it always have to start from somewhere, right? Like I think I was talking to a CPO of a company and then she said, like, this is very overwhelming. Like, where do I even start, right? CPO and so on. So I kind of like step back and say, okay, to me, it's quite systematic and know how to do it, when to stop and so on. But I can imagine that it's actually when hearing all the things I say, you should consider this and that, it could sounds like, oh, yeah, it's quite scary. And so I think one misperception I want to clear out for now, to start with, is a lot of people have these misperceptions that they only need to think about culturalization when they are ready to go to a new market. So they say, okay, don't talk to me first. Like, let me sort out my UK market first, for example. And then I will get in touch again once I'm ready for the new market. It's actually quite risky to do that because, you know, ultimately your service, it has to grow somewhere, because if you're only one market, you're actually going to be quite restricted in terms of your growth. And like it or not, even you are not in other markets, you have users from other markets using your products in this country, or you not even like organically grow up into other markets. So it's very important for CEO and to start with, or any startup to have this mindset of global mindset, so that you can set up your product and business proposition from the very beginning that is easily adaptable in the future for other markets, so that you don't have to rebuild everything, so you don't have to rethink your value propositions because it's so hard to convert into other culture or other value. So it's very important to have that. And if you have that mindset to kind of help you on your very early strategy, and also throughout the process that you make decisions with your team, it's good to have all this mindset, global mindset to start with. So once you're ready to go, it's actually easy. You don't have to kind of go back again.
Yeah. So you get sort of culturalization debt otherwise, where you kind of haven't prepared the ground.
Yeah. So there's one example, one project, a startup actually, they did it in the right way, where I work with their health related startup. And they know that because the investors are from other countries, they say, you start off in the UK, but eventually we want you to go to other places. So because it's medical related, we did some research in the UK, but all the output is very, very NHS focused, right? NHS way of like doing this, you know, like pregnancy, you have, I think, 16 weeks before you start going checking, and you call it you have a very different way of managing the whole pregnancy, for example. But once you move to other country, it's very different. So if they set their value propositions and also their content in a certain way, then it's actually really hard in the future to do that. So, you need to think about it from the very beginning. So you build a system in the right way rather than really hard to kind of convert in the future. So, yeah, that is a very starting point.
I was just wondering, you know, out of all the things, because you talk in quite a lot of detail about how to set up the research and how to work with local people. You have that sort of global thing going on, which is sort of the space you operate in, that sort of global, local, and the sort of partnerships. There's a lot in there. It's very, very useful, very, very tactical for people. I can't wait to share it with my students. I have a lot of international students, actually, mostly international students. Some are kind of really interested, and they often want to do something around their own communities, around their kind of own ethnic or country communities. And I think this would be really, really useful, obviously incredibly useful for companies. You know, there's been this whole conversation in design recently about, you know, the death of UX research and you know, everything is, you know, research is being, in the product world, research just sort of being pushed under product and all the rest of it. But there's clearly a case for two things here. One is, I think you really lay out the case for why actually having specialists who know what they're doing is really important, and not just, you know, anyone can do research. Everyone should kind of do a little bit, I think, but not everyone can do research at the level of kind of cultural nuance there. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between someone like you doing this and, you know, a product owner or someone saying, well, you know, I can do some of that, or, you know, we'll get just a couple of people?
Yeah, I think it's two layers, right? Like the thing you mentioned earlier, like we see so many out there, like people saying researcher should be the one doing research because other people can do it, but it's not to that extent. So that is the standard research we are talking about. But when you add to the cultural elements, there's another layer, which is even more complicated. Even the normal researcher might actually
struggle with it.
Yeah, the researcher that actually doing the normal research might not even consider, because it's a second layer of complexity that you have. So yes, it comes with experience, but also the mindset as well, in terms of how you see things slightly differently and know what to look into. So it's from my experience as well, from the very beginning when I do international research, and I'm a researcher, I'm a good researcher, but then there's some elements that I didn't know already if I compare it now that I know. Okay, if you go to, for example, Japan, what are the things that I already know some of the behaviors and the culture elements that I know for this company, because it's talking about working tools, like work management tools, and there are elements that I can bring in already hierarchical and things like that. But when I work with, for example, Spotify in the same market, then I know actually it's a different one from Asana when I work on work management tool, that the things that the cultural insights and nuances that is important for Asana might not be for Spotify anymore, and vice versa and so on. So it's kind of, and then knowing those kind of cultural nuances that might impact the people's behavior for this company before you go into research is very useful. Because then you actually have a bit of idea where you want to dig deeper into it, what kind of questions you might want to kind of put it into the discussion guide and probe more into as well, because it's relevant to that market. Knowing that the mobile data is very expensive on that market, how is that going to influence, you know, things like that. So very beginning when I do my internet research, I didn't know that. I just like going in and trying to hear any differences and new nuances that I can pick up so that we can say, okay, this is very different. So that comes with experience in terms of picking up what to do. But then like my book was doing, there's big part of it is very tactical, like you say, it's practical in the thing. So even I wanted to write another book more strategic, but I kind of like, maybe I find a balance between the two. But these tactical bits, put in the book, like from the project management side, like to choose who you should kind of pick to work with to start with, and also when you kind of plan for your timeline and timing, you have time differences, not just that, but you have different culture and festivals, you have things that they care about, Ramadan that is happening, then you need to know what to do and what not to do, and organize your research in differently. And then to the point of how you brief your moderators, your teams, and then how you brief interpreters and translators, because they're important. So there are a lot of small elements within all this. It's very important.
Yeah. There's a thing that strikes me with this, and it's sort of unsurprising in many respects. You know, there's a lot of relationship to accessibility. You know, it's very different for someone who's a sighted person to design something for someone visually impaired and kind of read all the literature and sort of try and do that versus having someone who's visually impaired actually be on that team and kind of tell them about the sort of reality of it. You know, because a similar kind of, I think, cultural relationship. There's a thing that struck me, though, in that example where, you know, an OXO, I don't know if you know the people who make kind of kitchen utensils, sort of famously, there's that idea of if you make it good for those people, you actually make it good for everyone else. Can you think of any examples where there's been like an adjustment or an insight that from, because often we're sort of talking about a company, and like I said, it's often a US or sort of European company moving into another culture, where there has been an insight in that culturalization moment where they've gone, actually, you know what, that should flow the other way, that what the changes we've made here for this particular culture or this market would actually be really beneficial if we kind of pushed it back to the original market and it goes the other way.
So that is kind of like the thing about identify not just differences, but similarities, right? Because that is quite similar. Yeah. Like you go to other markets, you say, oh, that is very different. And then can that apply to any other market as well? So that is actually grow that. So for example, with Spotify, in the Western markets, we have the individual plans and family plans and so on. So you have monthly payment. But in country, like we identify, like for example, Indonesia, for example, like, or actually Philippines to start with, people actually care about paying things. As I mentioned in my book, like people like to pay things in a small sachet, a garlic, you buy two cloves. Sachet mentality, because they don't want to waste it from, you know, from the history. They so care about just taking what they want or buying what they want or need. So that mentality is still here, even though the wealth is actually better in a lot of areas, but because it's what they're familiar with. So this behavior or mentality move into digital as well when they think about paying music. But I'm not going to listen to music in 2 days in this week or 3 days next week because I'm busy. So, but I'm paying for the whole month and I'm wasting and I'm not taking the best value out of that. So they have this mentality. So one of the things that came out after that is how do we actually have these propositions that help them to overcome this sachet mentality? So they came up with a mini plan. Mini plan is where you can play per day or per week. And you say, oh, next week I'm going to listen to music a lot. I'm going to pay with that first. And then so they can pick and choose, don't feel like they wasted. And then we realized actually there are a lot of other markets actually have similar mentality mindset, but also because the way that they being paid monthly, their salary is not being paid monthly, it's bi-weekly or daily. So this kind of proposition or plan is actually useful for them as well. So we start to kind of, as Spotify started to kind of look into which market is actually better. So kind of spread out to other markets as well. So this is kind of examples of you look in one and actually there's a similarity that you actually can spread out to other markets as well. It might not be all markets, but there are certain markets that you can look into.
No, but I can imagine. I mean, the thing that comes to mind for me, you know, here is the idea of sort of teenagers on a kind of prepay plan who's maybe got kind of pocket money, and part of that pocket money is to be spent on those kinds of things rather than the parents just kind of paying the subscription or whatever, and that they might want to kind of eke it out in a different way. I can see that.
But of course, it's like they probably, there's options, there's a possibility to do that. But as a business, you probably need to see how much conversion would be. Like you might capture the market share this little, but then it's actually not worthwhile because there's complications on logistics and also licensing and things like that. So it's always balance between the culture and also the business.
So this brings me on to the next thing, actually, because, you know, yes, there is a lot of tactical stuff in the book, but there's also this whole kind of aspect of strategic research versus tactical research and how to sort of take one brief that's very tactical and be more strategic. And I thought it was a very kind of valuable thing, actually, because I think I hear quite a lot of stories of people feeling like they're a bit boxed in by the brief as a research and they really want to do more strategic stuff, but can't, you know, they're not getting the brief. Mm. What's your approach to to sort of pushing upstream a little bit more.
Yeah. So yeah, I always say that it's good to do tactical, but at the same time, if you want to be seen more valuable to your stakeholders or to the business, it's actually good to have input into the strategic insights. So examples that I actually gave in the book as well is that, you know, for example, if you're asked or tasked to do a tactical risk usability test, go and test this pricing is working for this market or this payment is good. You could do that, but at the same time, you could also, I want to see like sneak in is the right word, but
yeah, I think it's fair enough.
You can put in some, include some strategic information so that you can gather more strategic insight for the company. So for example, talking about pricing and also like how they go about paying. So you can actually include understanding how people in that culture view value, their willingness to pay, what actually increase their willingness to pay. So for example, in India, there's this culture of I need to share with other people. So anything I pay that I can be share with other people, like paying for video streaming is actually more willingness than music, because video, your whole family can see it. You don't feel like you're being selfish. You pay for it, everyone can. But music is personal. Should I pay it? Because it's only me going to use it and enjoy the benefits of it. So there's all this value, how there's perceived value. It's very strategic because it's not just about information to inform your pricing strategy, but also inform your other propositions that you can put it in on how to make things more appealing to them to want to be able to pay off, can justify to pay. So you can include all those questions and to understand the reason behind of their decisions of those pricing decisions that they made and start gathering that. Every single tactical research you did, you gather some strategy insights. As you grow them, you actually can start to see bigger pictures in that instance. And these are the things that might open up to the business to say, oh, we did never heard about that. Maybe we should do more research in that area so that we can do that. So yeah, that is kind of a trick really to do more than you ask. To show
I really like to. I mean, I think sneaking it in is fine to say, because, you know, I like the idea that you're not asking for permission here, really, and that you're speaking to someone for, I don't know, for an hour or whatever anyway. You might as well kind of ask them some of that stuff. But also this idea that you don't know what you don't know, right? So if you're just asking some stuff and it's very narrow, you never have that experience of finding out stuff you didn't know. And by including some of that strategic stuff, I guess you can go back and go, well, here's the answer to the questions you asked me to kind of find out. But actually, here's some other stuff which suggests maybe we were asking the wrong questions, or there's something else out there that we didn't even kind of consider.
Yeah,
and that's very powerful. I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, and also you don't have to rely on that specific user testing sessions to gather this. Yeah. You can do some desk research if you're actually interested as well. It's like, I think very interesting about pricing. Maybe I can do a bit of desk research myself to find out, is there any more questions that I, or angle that I haven't thought of that I should bring it in to help you to guide that as well, as a starting point of conversations?
Yeah. When I hear all of this, and I know this is a problem for my students, I've seen it, you know, firsthand in projects I've worked on. It seems to be sort of a massive problem now. A lot of research teams, they'll use some kind of platform. A lot of them use Notion as the storehouse for their stuff. And part of the problem with something like Notion is, its USP is a kind of lack of friction to make a page and make a subpage and sub-subpage. It's really easy, but that's also its Achilles heel, right? Because everyone can just chuck stuff in there. How much time do you spend on, I don't know if this is really research ops, but, you know, how much time do you spend on the kind of curation and making sure that, you know, the data is curated, and whether it's kind of tagged or placed or kind of stored in a way that people can access it and then it makes sense and so forth. Because a thing I hear quite often is teams do a whole bunch of research and then it sort of gets forgotten about and the company just carries on doing whatever they're doing anyway. And then you get caught in that catch-22 of people say, well, there's not really much value in the research. And it's partly because they didn't bother to kind of connect that up. You know, they're faced with a load of data, but they don't really know how to do the both the synthesis and analysis, and analysis and synthesis part, as well as the communication part of it, for it to be useful at the other end. Mm. They sort of get a bit disconnected.
Yeah. I think there are two parts in your question, isn't it? One is presenting it, and then because when you're creating an output, you can straight away create something that is actually usable right away and then easily to be stored. And then the second part is like, where or how do you store it? So the first part is very important. Like in my book, I didn't talk about like how to present in the nice way and like graphics and things like that, because that is quite standard, like storytelling. Yeah. But the other part that is really important when it comes into reporting culturalization related information is to be able to kind of link the output that you get from your participants, make it relatable to your stakeholders, so they are more able to kind of receive it. So you, the example is like, for example, you spend 10 hours, 20 hours in doing research and looking into all data and everything, and then the stakeholders is only have an hour for them to understand and receive it and to kind of feel what you feel about the locals and everything. So you have to empathize them to know where they're coming from and the decisions they need to make and so on. So you use metaphor, for example, that there are a few tricks that I use. You use metaphor that they can relate to. You use things that they're familiar with. Like in this market, you do this, but in the other market, they're actually doing this because, you know, like kind of relate them. And then you can, depending on the stakeholders and how much they want the detail is, because every single individual's actually one different thing. I work with a chief growth officer that who want every single stories of each participants as well as the high level stories. So they want the details and big, but then some of them just want to know the main story. Just tell main story and what to do. So you need to pick and choose which one, and similarities and differences as well. So you could have a big report, you can have a summary, you can have highlights and things like that you want to be able to store it easily. The second bit of our storing is very depending on the company I work with. They might have their own way of doing it, so I probably wouldn't be as much influence in terms of how they do that. But if I get to kind of get into the smaller company, like talking about how they should do that, a lot of times I kind of make sure that they have a easier way to kind of put in similarities and differences. And also as the new markets that they do more research in, there's an easier way for them to add it in so that you make the insights become a clearer puzzles, if you like.
Yeah.
So think about it like you have insights from research A, you put it in a few puzzles, and then you have research B, you have more. So you kind of add the whole picture bigger and bigger. So find a way to do that as well.
Yeah. You talk about a whole range of methods actually in the book, and you know there's some qualitative and quantitative. You know, there is that big picture is sometimes like what's the top five or what's the one number or that kind of stuff can be often the case. My experience being the thing I always say is that I think that stories are what convince people, right? And can they stick with people? And you talked about metaphors, and I love metaphors, and those are things that people carry with them, and they're really compelling. But the numbers or the sort of facts and figures give people permission to believe in the story. But if you just have the numbers on their own, you're kind of missing a whole lot. And if you just have the story on their own, you're also missing. Has that been your experience, or is your experience different?
Yeah, it's very much so. I think if you do qualitative research, then story is very good because you have all the photos and things like that to accompany it so people can see, oh, this is their environment, rather than, like you say, about Christmas. Like if you take a photo of Christmas, it's like snow and everything. And then you say Christmas in Australia is like barbecue and things like that. So you can actually see it and feel it. So qualitative story is very important. Sometimes people tend, some clients or some researcher tends to want to say 2 out of 6 participants say that, or 4 out of 5. Yeah. That sometimes is not strong enough. Sometimes it's good indication, but it's not strong enough to say the figure. So unless you have statistic that you can pull in from internal statistic or data that you have, you work with the company's data scientists to say, can we pull information about this and that? And then say, actually, this is aligned with our data internally, as well as your stories, then that will be very powerful. Or sometimes you say, actually, it's not aligned, but why? Then the why is really interesting. And you say, maybe because when they're doing that, we collecting data, we collect in a different way, there's other way, or the other way around. So that kind of data is really, really useful. if you only do quantitative, then you have a lot of data, you have a lot of numbering and so on. But then again, you lack of the story. It's very hard to create a story with just quantitative. Yeah. So a lot of times, actually, when we see quantitative is useful, is when it pair up with qualitative. The order could be different from where you are at that stage and how much you know, and also the scope of the research. Sometimes you do quant first and then you do qual. Sometimes it's the other way around, makes more sense.
Yeah, relying on quant data on its own seems like a great way to completely miss cultural context.
Yeah.
Because you're not getting that human part.
You can't explain why.
Yeah. Apart from hiring you, of course, and buying your book, what are the kind of first steps if you're, I don't know, if you're a UX researcher or if you're kind of in the C-suite of a company, what would be the sort of the first small step they could do in this direction?
I always say that when I go into a new company, like, oh, where do we even start thing? Which I want to come back about the CPO that mentioned overwhelming very quickly later on. But if you are kind of very beginning of that, you can say, okay, we have limited budget, like we can't just go out and do big research and so on. Yeah. Actually relevant to this CPO conversations is like, you can actually start small, right? First of all, it's actually very important if you haven't done so in your organization is to sit down and bring in all the knowledge you have about a market first. Saying, okay, we have a bit of data. Let's say you're already in that market, but it's not doing very well and so on. And go through all the data, informations you might be able to collect. Is there any other way you can think about how you analyze data? Because sometimes data is that. You can find a different way to analyze them so that it's actually become more useful for you. All the insights and everything. In my book, I have a four buckets exercise that I mentioned. That is very useful to bring all the knowledge together, all the assumptions people have, especially C-level say, yeah, I think they work like this and we should just do decisions like that. And a lot of them are very subjective view or stereotype or certain thing. So bring all of them together, go through that exercise, four buckets, is known facts, strong hypothesis, weak hypothesis, and then unknowns. Put them in the right buckets, but make sure that the facts are indeed facts. So questions about the sources, the validity, like how long ago that this insights was provided, because things might change. And so to make sure that anything in the fact, you can actually take actions. That's why you have to make sure they are really, really sure. If you're not sure, put them in a strong hypothesis, because then you'll kind of find a certain way to say how else we can validate or invalidate that. Yeah. And so on. Yeah. Start from there, and then you have information about, do we even need to do research or what type of research, how big the research should be. If we collect all this and we do one-off research, could we answer a lot of these questions already? Can we do that, stretch a bit of budget to do that? Yeah. So it's kind of like finding the balance of all of them and see where that actually comes in. It doesn't have to be like big, overwhelming. It could start somewhere. And if let's say you say, oh, we have a very small teams and oh, this insight is enough for us to make a roadmap for now, and that is fine. And then you probably see some growth, leave it and then see some growth. And then you might want to focus on other markets at the meantime and then come back to this again. It's fine to do that. It's a progressive journey. So you don't have to make sure that you do everything right in one go.
So how did you respond to the CPO who said, this is all too overwhelming?
It's so interesting. Actually, I have 1 hour session with her after that. And we go back to the questions, like they were in a few countries already. Just like, how do you even start choosing which country to go into and to focus next? She's like, don't know, like maybe we just guess. And because it's language, it's easier for us to get into. Just like, okay, there's another exercise I normally do with client to choose. This is not in the book, actually. Which market is actually for you to go into? Either to launch or to focus on, and to put more money to focus on. So it's essentially it's looking into potentials and opportunities versus efforts and frictions. And then within that, there are a few elements that you need to look into to make sure that is correct. So yeah, I mentioned about that, and then we kind of go back step for backwards as well. And then, because the questions that she asked during the sessions was, We have all this data. We want the market or do the marketing. How do we do the marketing? I just like, well, step back. Why do you want to do the marketing? What insights and things like that? So a lot of companies very focused on a specific question. What should we do now? Like, should we just do marketing very well? Should we just change the products? But there are a lot of things you need to step up back and ask the right question to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. You can kind of see the pressure for kind of speed and let's just do a thing. What's the simple thing we need to do? And then we'll just market it and that's it. Yeah. Hey, look, I could talk to you for ages about this because I find it really fascinating. And, you know, people and culture is always very fascinating too. But we are coming up for time. The show is called Power of 10 because it's based on this Eames film called Powers of 10. It's about the relative size of things in the universe. And, you know, people can Google it and find it. It's really fascinating. But it's really about this idea of operating at different Zoom levels. And I think one of the things you've been talking about is, you know, there are cultural things and they are sort of evidenced in very detailed ways. You know, and I think it's always interesting in a mostly globalized world where you go somewhere else, especially in Europe. I go to another European country and it's kind of like the same as every other European country, except for small things like, you know, the post boxes or the shape of milk bottles and those kinds of things and cultural norms, of course. So the very final question is, you know, what one small thing is either overlooked or could be redesigned that would have an outsized effect on the world?
I think for me, it's this notion. I have this thinking, but I haven't actually expanded myself to say, what does that actually mean? Because that might be a second book that I want to write about cultural elements, not just on business, but also politics and, you know, culture in a sense. But I think it's the notions of, we are all human, right? We are on the same species. And it feels like we are very, very, very different, which is true. We are different in certain ways. One country share the same thing for the other, but not the other thing or the other culture element. So there are differences for sure. But we are all the same human species. The reason we are different is because 100,000 years ago, like we kind of, ancestor kind of evolved very differently in different environment, so that changed our gene, their skin color, their where everything that we have in the language. And then I don't know when the whole border thing start off and people start to become, oh, you are there, I'm here. And, you know, like the human evolutions, I guess, and it's all start from the same thing, but it's just evolved slightly differently. Just like a family member, you go to a different culture to grow up a different way than your cousin might be slightly different from you, but you're all the same family. You see what I mean? So I'm kind of like, especially in this world that so many discriminations or, you know, the culture people, I'm just thinking about actually we're different, but we're actually also the same. The reason we're different is because evolutions slightly differently. I think it's kind of like, I think the small thing that you're talking about is actually quite big in the notions of we are the same, but you see what I mean? It's really hard to describe that at the moment, but I just, it's the whole thing of, we kind of need to be just emphasize why people are different and be open about it rather than criticize each other for the differences that we have.
It's like when astronauts talk about the overview effect, you know, when they see the world, you know, from space and you can't see any borders, right? Yes. And all you just see is this fragile thing protected by this fragile layer of atmosphere that keeps us all alive.
Exactly.
It changes them.
And we breathe, it's the same airways, we drink the same water, sea water, you know, it's the same. It's just, if we have all those in that perceptions, then we cannot accept everyone work. There's no right or wrong way to do things. It's everyone's way to do things. So be more acceptable, open to learn about that.
That is a very big, small thing.
I know, I'm sorry.
So where can people find you online and where can people find your book as well?
I'm most active on LinkedIn, so come find me on my name and connect if you like or get in touch. My website is beyo.global, beyo.global. I have some content and also all the works I have done in the past that, because every end of each year, I wrote a summary, a roundup for every things that I have done for that year. So I didn't do it first year and then I started doing that for the rest of the year. So I probably have 5 or 6 of them there. So it's very detailed of every work that I've done. And then my book, I have this book here. It's on, you can find it on Amazon on your area or country or regions, or Apple Books if you don't really want to buy it from Amazon.
I'll put all the links in the show notes for people to find you. Are you active on any other socials anywhere, or is it LinkedIn?
No, just LinkedIn for now. I'm on Twitter, but I don't tweet. Where else? I don't know. I'm kind of in between social and also private. Yeah. One is enough for me.
It's probably wise.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
No, thank you so much for having me.
You've been watching and listening to Power of 10. You can find more about the show on Pauline.com, where you can also check out my leadership coaching practice, online courses, as well as sign up for my irregular newsletter, Doctor's Note. And I'll put all the links in the notes too. If you have any thoughts, then please put them in the comments or get in touch. You'll find me as @apauline on pkm.social. You'll find me on LinkedIn or my website. Thanks for listening and watching, and I'll see you next time.